Hi, this is Heather Esposito, and this is Leadership by Design. Welcome to today's episode of Leadership by Design. Today, we're excited to welcome back Dr. Dan Radecki, who is the co-founder of the Academy of Brain-Based Leadership, which offers a scientifically validated brain-based approach for future-oriented leaders and organizations. He also serves as Executive Director of Research and Development at AbbVie, Inc., where he is a global leader for their drug development programs. Dan holds a bachelor's in psychology, a master's in biopsychology, and a PhD in neuroscience. He co-authored the book, Psychological Safety, Managing the Hidden Drivers of Individual Behavior and Team Success. He's been published in the Harvard Business Review, developed a TEDx and delivered a TEDx keynote, and he's lectured internationally on topics such as the neuroscience of resilience, leadership wisdom, the biology of collaboration, and the impact of stress on the brain. So Dan, I wanted to thank you for coming back on our podcast, and I wanted to invite you back on because, as you know, we are in the middle of an integration to bring together two historic companies. And I know you personally have been through a number of mergers and acquisitions throughout your career. So what I wanted to explore with you today is a little bit more about how to look at that through the lens of neuroscience and how we can effectively support our leaders and teams as they start to navigate that. So welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Heather. And this is a timely topic because of not only what you're talking about with the integration that you're going through, but in the midst of the background of a pandemic and all that people have gone through over the past 18 months. So it's sort of a double whammy when you think about it from the brain's perspective.
It is. So what is the question I should be asking you? Is it more about readiness for change or resilience through change?
Yeah, I think of them together, that the resilience will bring about the readiness for change or as ready as we can be. But yeah, I think the question, you know, I've talked about this a lot with my team members at work and outside of work in terms of with what's going on in our brains with this global, everyone is impacted by it, this pandemic. And the key that comes up is the uncertainty and how it leads to stress and what that does to our brains. How do we manage all that? Because it's not really, I mean, we're finding this out. It's not usually in our lives, if we have something that's a roadblock to us or that's causing us distress, we can usually shy away from it or avoid it. You know, I can avoid the pain of running marathons that I get in my knees and ankles by stop running marathons and there, it's solved. But with what's going on in our lives now for the past 18 months and counting, with this pandemic, there's a tremendous amount of stress. And it's not a viable strategy to say, well, I'm just going to avoid all this stress that's been associated with the uncertainty. We have to somehow figure out how to manage it, or it's going to drive us, literally, it's going to drive us crazy. So I like the idea of understanding resilience and how to build resilience in us individually, and then how we can sort of, after that, build it on a wider scale in our teams and our organizations.
Okay, so how much does fatigue play into this as well? I mean, you know, we have pandemic fatigue, we have Zoom fatigue, and is that the right question I should be asking?
I think so. I think so. If we go to this, the idea of the biological systems and how we're wired, fatigue is a huge issue, not just with our brain and what we're talking about here, but just in general. So what I like to focus on with my teams is the idea that we have a brain that is really good at what it wants to do is resolve conflicts in our world. It's almost like an error resolving machine. So if we have our life, our brain sets up our life and our world the way we expect it to be, we have a lot of expectations. And when those expectations aren't met or something is different than we think it should be, that's where an error signal comes up. Okay, it's like a computer. So you have an error signal. And now we have to do something about this error signal. So what do we do when things aren't what we expect? You know, I expected to be going into the office every day and collaborating and being able to travel. Now I can't do that for the past 2 years. So that's a big error in my brain. How does my brain deal with that uncertainty? And what we're finding is that when you've got a lot of uncertainty, our brains are going to require a lot of energy, a lot of cerebral energy in these higher brain areas to deal with that. And our brain is really selfish. It is going to prioritize energy from the rest of our body. So when we're in a situation of constant stress, constant uncertainty, it's going to sap energy from our typical systems in our body to our brain to deal with it. And that comes, that's where fatigue comes in. And literally fatigue, we call it allostatic load. The body, if we don't have what we need in our world, if we don't have that sense of certainty, we pull the energy from the rest of our body. And that leads to some consequences. Consequences we're starting to see with inflammation, diabetes, cardiovascular events. So it's pretty sobering when we start to think about what that fatigue can do to us, not just to our brain, but to our general health.
And so how, like you mentioned, we're going through just some global change, much less what we're going through with our organization.
Yeah.
So how do leaders and their teams, first of all, just take care of themselves on that physical level you were just describing?
Yeah. And that's where we really focus on the psychological safety aspect of it. Because if you can, with all this going on, and I'll just boil it down to uncertainty, because the uncertainty in it during an acquisition, during a merger, there's, and I know from personal experience, that has been sort of the one factor that really pushes people down a rabbit hole. So you've got that uncertainty, and then in a normal world, an M&A, the uncertainty associated with that would really push a lot of people's stress buttons and triggers. But now, in the face of what's going on in our world, it just magnifies it. So I think what we need to do is think about how we can, in ourselves, maintain our psychological safety. If we can't do it with the aspect of certainty, how can we build our psychological safety in other areas that are important to our brain? So it's almost a workaround. And then once we can do that, how do we do it for our people so that we're having our teams at least functioning to some extent and not just totally collapsing? So that's where we then get into psychological safety. How do we build up the psychological safety as a result? It's almost a protective mechanism against what happens with uncertainty and stress.
Yeah. So let's just assume that right now there's just certain pieces of this that are not going to be certain.
Yeah.
We're just in that planning and implementation stage, never done this before. So now it's a matter of working through that. When you talked about addressing other parts of psychological safety as a workaround, can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah. And that's why I loved the safety model that we use so much. So in thinking about what are some of the key low-hanging fruit, these variables that we, all of our brains need to impart psychological safety on us, if we can't, certainty is one of them. Okay. Security and certainty is a big one. And if we're going to just say, all right, that's something we're going to have to be okay with not being certain these days and having that sense of security. What can we do about that? All right. Well, we can think about maybe then bolstering the other variables that are important for our psychological safety. And in the safety model, that would be things like our sense of control. All right. I don't have certainty about what's going on, but at least I can get a little bit of, I can impart on myself more autonomy or control over what's going on in my world. I can really focus on ensuring fairness, that my people feel like they're being treated with a sense of fairness, bolster their sense of esteem, and ensure that it's a trusting environment, even going overboard to ensure that that people feel that there's trust and that there's a collaboration and good communication. So what I've done with my teams in these situations, and fortunately it wasn't during a pandemic, but it was still hard enough, is soften the impact of uncertainty by decreasing some of these other brain triggers. So I'll give you an example. When we were going through a real contentious acquisition in my company, my team members were hit hard because they were really worried about having, because being located in Southern California, they were worried about having to relocate to the Midwest, which none of them would do. So there was a lot at stake here in terms of having to move or get another job and switch career paths. So because we didn't, we really had no sense of certainty about any of it. The security was really lacking. We really went overboard in looking at over-communicating trying to get that sense of transparency to at least give them a little bit of idea of some of the security, even though we couldn't tell them a lot. We set up regular meetings to give them the notion that as leaders, we didn't know any more than they knew, okay? And we had discussions, and so that helped a little. But what we really did was focus on some of those other areas that are important for psychological safety. So the autonomy area, you'll probably appreciate this being in the business you are. In their autonomy area, autonomy is an important need for my team. And I knew that since security was being challenged, maybe I can go overboard helping them with their sense of autonomy. So what we did was we were in the process of renovating our workspace. So we typically had standard office furniture and equipment that was just put into the offices. We went to the point where we gave them online catalogs, and they could choose anything they wanted. They were able to choose their furniture and their decorating their offices the way they wanted to. It sounds like it's trivial, but it actually helped them because it was building up even more their autonomy and sort of giving them that need that we know that that was important to them because security was lacking. And we also set up to appeal to their need for trust, team bonding, regular team bonding. We call them gripe sessions, where they were allowed to get together with their peers in a social setting and just talk about what was going on for them and sort of bond over their, as they called it, shared misery. These things seemed to help because they were getting that need for trust met, and it was even helping a little bit. And because the reason I was doing this is what we found is that all these variables for psychological safety that we use in the safety model, if one of them is lacking, by building up some of the other ones, it can help to some extent. It can help decrease that stress on the brain and that energy load that I talked about. So even though we couldn't address directly the uncertainty, indirectly, we helped the psychological safety by appealing to the other variables and paying more attention to those to help the overall sort of stress response.
Yeah, as I was hearing you talk about that, especially I was thinking about the autonomy. If you feel like you have some control over some areas, it helps you feel like not so much a victim of the things that are outside of your control, even though, like you said, they may be small things, but it feels a little empowering to just feel like there's something that you can do, you have choice over.
Yeah, and it's amazing in those situations, particularly when there's that much angst and stress about all of this, how the little things can help. We also had another one. I made a point of actually going through the safety model with everyone and understand it. And I remember the meeting where I did this. We outlined the acronym safety. And then I said, let's take this S off the table. Let's just cross it out because security, let's face it, we're not.
We
can't do anything about it. Now let's focus on the other ones, guys, because these are important to your brain. And then we went down the line and talked about how we can do this. And for the esteem one, which we had a problem with, how do we bolster people's sense of their self-worth and how others see them if they're all really down and worried about, it was just a rabbit hole. So we implemented this online thing we called Way to Go, which was an online sort of recognition program where if I was working with Karen and she went out of her way today to really dig into data and get things done, I could go on this online portal and click and give her a $10 Starbucks gift card and just a little message. And that was actually, and one of the suggestions from the team members was, yeah, let's do that, but let's make it public. Let's show when people get rewards. So you get rewarded and there's a public recognition that you were rewarded. And people it escalated. People love this, especially during that time. They went out of their way to recognize each other. And when the program was over, when the merger was completed and this Way to Go thing sort of went by the wayside, the biggest feedback we got during an employee engagement that year was they wanted that back. They wanted that public recognition for each other. And so we continued it. And that was a way of building up that sense of esteem during these difficult times.
Yeah, for us, I mean, that really ties back to the leadership principle of cultivating connection? And what are some of the unique ways that you did to think about cultivating connection, building trust and belonging? I think when you were talking about that idea of our shared human experience, if you get isolated, it's really easy to start telling yourself a story that you're the only one that feels like this. You're the only one going through this. Somehow it's impacting you differently. And when you can have that conversation with others and realize, oh, okay, we're all going through this. I don't know. It feels like it develops some empathy, builds some belongingness around.
I think that was our take-home message from those gripe sessions that they did, that it really helped them. I hate to use that phrase, misery loves company, but I think there's an opposite to that, where managing misery and these stress responses is best done with collaboration. There's something magical about that. If you look at the whole study of the Blue Zone initiative years ago, where they looked at all these areas in the world where people lived long lives into their 90s and hundreds, and they lived it with a good quality of life. It's not like they were in pain and invalids. They found one of the key principles was this idea of social connectedness. And there's this belief that social connectedness can some way help us manage what stress does to the brain. So I think that's an important part. We do know that you mentioned the phrase victim, you know, this victim mentality. It's easy to go down that road of a victim mentality when these things happen to us, when we're alone and we allow that network of our brain to go unchecked. Having close relationships with others where you can talk this through, that seems to be helpful to our brain and our stress response.
Yeah, that connects right back to me. I mean, you and I have both talked before around some of Matthew Lieberman's work with something that he calls emotional labeling, and just giving language to an emotion we're feeling can help to diffuse that in some way, because now instead of the feeling of the emotion, I can look at it with more perspective and say, oh, well, this is frustration, or this is uncomfortableness, or whatever it may be. Yeah. Now I can look at it differently and maybe take some different actions on how I want to address it. But when it's just the emotion of it, it feels very powerful and sometimes overwhelming.
And that work that's been done, that's probably one of the most studied sort of ways to regulate emotions with labeling. And it's just so simple and effective. And we actually think that the process of psychotherapy and therapy, behavioral therapy, a lot of it rests on that idea of a trained therapist being able to guide you through labeling your emotions and not getting caught up in them. And it's really effective. It's really good. Behavioral therapy is as effective as any drugs out there for things like anxiety and stress. So there is something to that.
I never made that connection before between Lieberman's work and really what you do in therapy. That's interesting. Yeah. I never thought about that before.
It's just a way of elaborating on it. And the art is for the therapist to keep the patient from diving and just going down into rumination, where then it defeats the purpose. You actually get a converse effect where you get more stressed and more depressed. But yeah, it really is. And if you think about social collaborations with people who are close to you and that whole Blue Zone study, it may be that serves in that type of capacity. If you have friends where you can talk these things through, it may seem to help. If for no other reason, it gets you out of that amygdala emotional part of the brain and into that higher language center where you're talking and thinking, and just gives you that moment to get out of that amygdala hijack, as we say.
Yeah, there's got to be something to that as well, just around the idea of collective development. And hey, if we're all going through this, we can all band together. So now it becomes us against the thing versus me as an individual against the thing. Like there's power in numbers. There's got to be something around that collective piece as well, I would think.
Yeah. And that's why I mentioned the whole thing about misery loves company. But I know people like to think that way, but it seems to be the opposite as well, that the reason misery may love company is because there's something about that collaboration and that shared experience that allows you to deal with it better.
It makes a lot of sense. So how many of these like mergers, acquisitions, integration efforts have you been through in your career?
The last one I was in was May of 2020, which was a big one. So that's number seven for me.
Seven. Wow. And yeah. Have you been on both sides or have you always
been? I have. I've been on both sides. And it's definitely harder when you're the target and you're the one having to, make the changes and not only just deal with the changes, but then over the long run, implement things that are new systems, new processes. Mm. You're the one who has to do the change and not the other way around. So as I look back on it, I think, yes, it was harder to be the target of a merger and be the one who then has to make all the changes and understand a new process, a new way to work. But as I look at it in hindsight, I think it was actually better for me in those instances because it gave me the strategies and the capacity to be able to do that. There's no substitute for experience and going through that, it made it easier each time.
And I do think that we are trying to take a very thoughtful approach to, you know, obviously there's some of those processes that, one organization will, adopt the other organizations. And then there's some of it where we're just looking and saying, this is a new organization. What is it that we want to create? What's the best of both? What didn't work for either of us? And what can we redefine, which has some exciting, hopeful pieces to it of, you don't have to be defined by what you were. You can celebrate the best of that. And this can be in some ways a fresh start on some new thinking too.
And I think in what's helpful, and this is why I love psychological safety and the whole idea of it is, in one of the latest ones that I went through, there was a push up front to be able to have an open mind about, just like what you're saying. Let's, even though this is considered an acquisition and borderline hostile takeover, let's still do what's best for the people and the business. And that is, let's keep an open mind about just because I'm with the organization that's calling the shots and taking over, it doesn't mean that we have to dictate everything. If there are some processes that the company that we're taking over brings to the table that may be useful, let's think of it in terms of what's most useful for the people and the company and foster as much as we can a sense of psychological safety. So people are willing to have that open mind, set that sort of baseline culture where people feel free to speak up and they can actually feel free to do it in an environment where they don't feel like they're going to be humiliated or people are going to look at them strangely because they're coming at it from a different perspective. That was a little difficult to do, but once we did it, it really helped. It helped. I think the nice thing is our senior management saw that it helped the organization grow and it helped with the bottom line because we were truly choosing the best processes and not just the processes that we're most comfortable with.
It sounds like you really had maybe more of a challenging situation. You described it as hostile. Luckily, we're not in that boat. We're actually coming together because of an aspirational vision of what we believe we can create. So, there was an intentional reason of bringing the companies together because of a shared purpose. So hopefully we can avoid some of those pieces of just having to come from that place forward.
So it sounds like if you do have already established this shared goal, shared purpose, it could be fairly easy to always bring things back to that when issues come up, right? Okay, so what's best for the shared goal? Let's forget about who owns what. What's the best way, the best process to be able to get to that point?
Yeah, good point. As we wrap up today, what other kind of key lessons? I heard communicate, but what else or key lessons that you learned just as a leader leading a team going through something like that?
I think, and this goes back to the way Amy Edmondson, when she's researching psychological safety and the way she talks about it, how leaders should really approach building psychological safety. And that is when going through this, I found on both ends of it, as being the target of an acquisition and being the one doing it, that as a leader and as the leaders that I've seen that were most effective, they were very vulnerable during the process. Okay, they didn't. I know there's this sort of idea that you have to stand up there and keep a stiff upper lip and put on this persona that everything's fine and that you've got it all under control. But I really think it helped as a leader when you were open with your team to say, you know what? I'm going through the same thing you guys are. I have a lot of angst about what's going to happen, but here's how I'm trying to manage it. I really think that idea of shared vulnerability, of that openness that Amy Edmondson talks about in A Truly Psychologically Safe Team, I think that's more important than ever when you're in a scenario of a merger and acquisition and a lot of uncertainty. I think it really resonates with your people when you do that because they see you as genuine, right? They don't. It already is a problem when you are going through this situation. And a lot of times leaders will come out and they'll say things and they'll give you an update. And there's a lot of mistrust. You don't believe it because, you know, you're out of your prefrontal cortex and you're dealing emotionally with the situation. If you really establish that sense of vulnerability with your people, it'll make things much easier.
Yeah, I think one thing I just heard though too, is it's not just about the shared vulnerability, like in terms of commiserating, but you mentioned vulnerability and then modeling. Like I'm going through the same thing. Here's what I'm doing. Here's how I'm helping myself so that you're modeling how to be how to create psychological safety and how to take care of yourself to a certain extent through this.
Yeah. And that's the Psych Safety 101 handbook from Amy Edmondson's research. It really is modeling it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you spending time with us today, Dan. I know you've done our rapid fire questions before, but I'll just ask you this one because so many of our listeners love hearing from our guests. What are you currently reading?
Currently reading, oh boy. You really want to know this?
Well, I don't know. Do I?
it's nothing too sexy, that's for sure. So there's a paper that that has to do with what we're talking about today, which is related to stress and uncertainty. And it's from an old colleague from years ago from a journal, Progress in Neurobiology. And it is all about uncertainty and stress. I happen to be looking this over because of some of the research I'm doing. And it's basically entitled Uncertainty and Stress, Why It Causes Disease and How It's Mastered by the Brain. It's this wonderful review article that was published a few years ago. And I always keep going back to it because it's by one of the gurus in the field, Bruce McEwen, a former colleague at Rockefeller University, but probably not something anyone's going to pick up at Barnes and Noble or online. But
it's just Amazon, a good publication.
Yeah. Yeah. So
no, I love that you keep stretching yourself and you keep learning. And as you mentioned, whether it's business conditions or whether it's us navigating the pandemic, how we support ourselves and understand what's happening in our brain to help ourselves manage it better is really important. And we have no lack of knowledge or lack of ability to learn more and more about the brain and how we can support it versus being a victim to it.
Exactly, that's the key.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again. Remember, everyone deserves to have a great leader, so keep working at being the best leader you can be. Until next time.
This podcast is an original production of Global Talent Management at Herman Miller Group. It's hosted by me, Heather Esposito, and produced in music by Sean Beck.